Today on Northern Latitudes, we're drilling into the science of ice cores. My guest is Allison Crisitello, director of the Canadian Ice Core Lab at the University of Alberta. Allison is one of the people on this planet who spends her days working with ice that fell as snow thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of years ago, preserving a record of the Earth's atmosphere, climate, and man's impact on the planet. In this conversation, we talk about what ice cores actually tell us, how they're collected, how they're read, and why they matter now more than ever. But we start with Allison's personal story. As a queer woman working in some of the most remote and traditionally male-dominated spaces in science. I'm Bill Ault, and this is Northern Latitudes.
Hi, my name is Allie Crisitello, and I am an ice core scientist and a high-altitude mountaineer.
And you are way more than that, but welcome to Northern Latitudes, Allison.
I don't know. What do you want me to say? I'm the director of Canada's National Ice Core Lab.
Yeah, well, that would have been a good one to throw in there, yeah.
Should I start over?
And also the winner of the 2025 Banff Centre Summit of Excellence Award. So we're going to start there because I know that's important to you. What did that award mean to you?
Oh, well, I'm glad you asked me about this. And first, actually, I think for a lot of reasons, this is really the most meaningful award in my career to date that I've received. And part of it has to do with who and where it came from. I mean, to me, it's really from the Canadian mountain community. And also the timing of it is just felt almost like a political statement, even though I don't actually think it was intended to be as such. I think it was intended to show very publicly support for me as a climate scientist, me as a queer woman, me as all the things that I am in the current general North American political climate. But another piece of it, I think, for me is that I'm not originally Canadian. I'm from Boston and from the States, and I moved here for my postdoc, and I'm a Canadian citizen now. So to receive also what just felt like an award from a community that has very much taken me in as someone not from this country originally and supported me in so many different ways and helped me achieve the things that I have since I came to Canada just felt very powerful. And it was a time, I think, when I probably needed that message of support in some ways to keep doing what I am doing.
And you said you grew up an American in the Boston area. Mm-hmm. How does an American growing up in the Boston area end up drilling ice cores for a living?
Well, I did grow up in Boston, but I'm an identical twin, and my twin sister and I did get into a lot of trouble in winter in the New England mountains since a very young age. And I became a U.S. climbing ranger in Washington State at a young age and worked as a mountain guide as well on Denali and Aconcagua at a relatively young age. So I did grow up in New England, but, you know, explored a lot in the wintertime, you know, in striking range from where we grew up. And then pretty quickly also went out west, like in my late teen years.
Yeah, you were a young ranger, right? And that was mostly in the American Northwest, correct?
Yeah, that's right. It was all in Washington State, in Olympic National Park and in the North Cascades. Yeah.
So before we get into the science, which is really exciting, and I really do want to talk about, I do need to talk to you a little bit about you. What's it like being a queer woman in this field and growing up through the rangers and all that stuff? Because I know that had to be a challenge.
Well, thanks for asking that too. I think I was pretty, I can't think of the right word. I guess stubborn.
That's a like good word.
When I look back on being, I was the only female in a lot of spaces I was in, and then also obviously the only queer woman in a lot of spaces that I was in when I was younger, particularly as a ranger and like a petite woman in spaces where I had an enormous amount of responsibility and was responding to very serious accidents and things like that, you know. And you show up on a scene and people just look at you and size you up before they see you at work, was well, I watched it in this climbing ranger world, but also in my academic world, drive women away. And I just became very kind of in your face, which I'm not at all at heart. And I think you would find if you met me now, I'm really not. But I did for a number of those years. Like, an example of what I mean is, I think I outwardly tried to make myself actually look really queer. Like, I spiked and bleached my hair and wore these huge bicycle spoke earrings. And I just was like, you know what, if you're going to like look at me and size me up, this is who I am. And you can watch me at work and then reassess your judgment of me, kind of a thing. And that really is not my natural character, but I wanted to stay in those spaces, and I did. But it definitely had an impact on me. And to this day, I probably do some things that this might resonate with a lot of female identifying people, but I think I put an enormous amount of pressure on myself when I'm leading expeditions and things to be, you know, not just a great team member or a leader, but to be the fastest and to be the strongest and to, you know, to like hold all these superlatives. And yeah, like I said, probably in some ways that's not healthy. You know, I overtrain and I do these things to an extreme level because I put that pressure on myself. And a lot of it is because of what you asked me, I think, because of these years of basically trying to prove that I belonged in all these places.
And you've certainly done that. Like I said, we're not going to get into the long list of stuff, but holy moly, when I started deep diving into your life, I'm going like, whoa. Just going to give an example, the first PhD in glaciology from MIT. Okay, now we're going to talk about ice cores.
Okay.
First of all,
I can't wait.
Mm. Well, I know what an ice core is. I mean, I think most people do, but tell us what they are and how it works.
Well, sort of most basically, right, as snow falls over time and snow gets buried and buried and buried and buried, it compacts, right? It gets compressed and compressed as you go down. And the more snow falls that's newer on top and pushes it down and down and down. And so as you go down, you eventually get to some pressure where snow becomes fern, which is really just compressed snow, and fern then becomes ice. And this all just has to do with, you know, basically how compressed it's getting. But the really important thing here is that you can imagine as you go from the surface, you know, if you're just standing on, say you're standing on a glacier surface, as you're standing at the surface and go down below your feet, you're going back in time. And that's the power of most paleoclimate records. They record, you know, various parts about climate and the environment over time, and they let us look back in time. So that's sort of very, very basically how it works. And I think most people, when we think about ice coring, they think about our big polar ice sheets, which of course offer us the longest look into the past. The Greenland ice sheet, the East and West Antarctic ice sheets. And I did actually focus for a lot of years only on the polar regions. And now at this point in my career, I actually have a different focus. I look more at the Canadian High Arctic, in part because I am here in Canada now. So smaller ice caps across the Canadian Arctic archipelago, as well as non-polar high mountain regions of the world, which look a little bit different. They're, you know, covered by glaciers, not ice caps and ice sheets, but they are places that preserve these climate records, maybe not as long. Maybe there's a lot of difficulty both in interpreting the records and also in retrieving them, but they are very, very valuable climate records in many cases from parts of the planet that are closer to where human populations live. So they may contain certain climate information that is very relevant to humans.
And is it more when you're doing a sample from, say, I don't know, Mount Logan or the Athabasca ice sheet, is it give you a more regional look at the past? Like, is it, can you say, especially weather-wise?
Yeah, that's a great question. So ice cores do contain global climate information. Like there are certain things you could, any ice core you drill anywhere in the world would contain, right? So they do contain global climate information. They also contain an enormous wealth of more local and regional climate information. And this is part of the focus, not just for myself, but a number of other sort of more mountain-focused paleo people. This is part of the sort of newer focus on high mountain non-polar regions. They're places that are melting, right? So we're losing these archives as we speak, the more recent years of these records. But because of these cores containing sort of this more local regional climate, they have this ability to tell us something that may be very directly relevant to, say, human health or drinking water supplies, this kind of thing. So you mentioned the Athabasca Glacier, which is one of the main outflow glaciers of the Columbia ice field, which is a really good example because that is a water tower. It is the source of my drinking water sitting here in Edmonton. And so when we went up there and drilled shallow ice cores a couple years ago, looking particularly at environmental contaminant burdens that are sitting up on Snow Dome that in our melting world are starting to melt more and more each year, and deeper parts of the snow and ice pack are melting out more and more, where locked up are contaminants that were actually emitted and deposited many decades ago, so before different sorts of environmental regulations happened. So yeah, just an example, certain legacy contaminants like DDT, things that, you know, were banned a long time ago, are actually melting out of the snowpack now. So a core from up there may give us a very sort of proactive look about a contaminant burden that's sitting up in what is a drinking water source and may come down the tap in the future.
Part of that elevation disappearances, what do they call elevation dependent warming? They're warming up a little faster than other parts of the world. Yes,
That's right. And the Logan, the St. Elias region in the Yukon is actually a really good example of that. This process by which higher elevations are actually warming at a faster rate in many cases than lower elevations. So it may not be the case. Like Mount Logan, the summit of Mount Logan doesn't go above 0 degrees Celsius. Like it doesn't actually have positive degree days where it's melting yet. But overall, and when we look over longer time periods, the warming that the higher elevations across the St. Elias is experiencing compared to lower elevations is actually more severe. And this is true in a lot of the world's high mountain regions. So yet another reason for a lot of the iceberg community at this point, I think, to refocus sort of areas of priority strategically around those kinds of regions where these climate records are being lost, at least in the surface.
So we have the legacy pollutants. We have the climate record. What else do ice cores teach us?
Or how long show is this us? Podcast?
We got lots of time.
Oh, this podcast is weeks long. That's so cool. I'm happy to mention a few.
Give me a few of the top of the list.
Okay, ones that people care the most about. These days, people care a lot about wildfires for obvious reasons. And there's some really cool things we can do in terms of wildfire reconstruction in ice cores. So, you know, because they're a look back in time and we can look at black carbon and all sorts of other kind of chemical markers to distinguish between combustion sources. We can see not only like changes in wildfire frequency and intensity in the past, but we can also measure all these different very long name sugars that tell us about changes in the vegetation that was burning over time. So they give a really detailed look historically at wildfire activity kind of from all three of those angles, which is very useful in predictive models and constraining and better, you know, projecting future wildfire activity. So that's one. I guess my original area of expertise was in sea ice proxy development, which is still something I think is very cool. I spend less time on, but what I mean by that is measuring different things in the chemistry of the ice itself for land-based ice caps and ice sheets and glaciers that can tell us about ocean conditions in the past. They can tell us about sea ice in the past. And this is really useful in a number of ways, but one, I guess, important broad fact is like we don't really know before the satellite era and observational periods, you know, what sea ice looked like. And it's a very important component of the climate system because it acts like a cap on the ocean, right? It stops ocean atmosphere exchange of many things, not just heat. But we don't really know what sea ice looked like, you know, before the satellite era. So these proxies, these things that let us like see maybe what sea ice and ocean surface conditions were doing in the past pre-satellite era over long periods of time is a very powerful tool. And so these are things like marine aerosols that we think of, normal sea salts, sodium chloride, magnesium, calcium. Those are non-biogenic, right? They come from sort of sea spray, but not from living critters in the ocean. And then there's another whole class that tells us a lot about biological productivity related to sea ice. And this was sort of my original area of expertise, is methanosulfonic acid, or MSA, this thing that you can measure in snow that actually originally came from phytoplankton in the ocean. Why am I even talking about this? My God. Anyways, this is
No, it's great. Go on, because this absolutely, and I'm sure people listening too, it absolutely fascinates me about how much you can learn from the molecular level, correct? And if I say anything wrong, you just say, no, Bill, that's not how it works. from the molecular level up, what you can learn about climate in the past, biology in the past, vegetation in the past, like some of these things, like I never even thought of you being able to do from an ice core. As a layman, and I think of ice cores, I think, okay, they're using it for climate. Yeah, the volcanic thing I've read a little bit about, you know, we can obviously see when a volcano erupted that gave enough ash to cover the... But like this kind of stuff, the molecular kind of level where you can start to project and see what the world was actually like, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, is just amazing. Like, and how... How does the climate analysis thing work? Because I think a lot of people think, oh, how can they tell what, you know, what the weather was like 10,000 years ago? And I think a lot of people have that doubt when it comes to ice core science. That's one thing where I think people have kind of like, I don't get it. Like, I get the ice thing and I get the snow thing, but how can they extract climate information out of that?
Okay. It's interesting to hear. It all comes down to first dating it, right? If I was talking to a skeptic, you're talking about depth in the first place, right? Like you're drilling an ice core down. This thing is on a depth scale. It means nothing on a depth scale. You have to put an age scale on it. And you just mentioned one of the most critical things in terms of chronologies, which is volcanoes. Volcanoes are really useful to us because you can fingerprint their tephras, the ashes that are found in the ice cores. And you can say, aha, at X depth, that was the 1912 Katmai eruption. And you put an exact date on that exact depth. So we call that a tie point, right? So there is a undisputable science, and it is complicated, but in terms of how we actually put the depth of an ice core onto an age scale. Volcanoes just being one example. We do all sorts of things. But one of the really cool things is that up until a certain depth where sort of time becomes too compressed, there is an annual signal in a lot of the chemistry of the core. Because even the marine aerosols I was just talking about, as you can imagine from what the source is and how they're produced, they have a seasonal signal. So say you know, when there's lots of open ocean, you get lots of sea salt. So there's a summer peak, which usually will correspond with your summer solstice. In the middle of the winter, where there's that sea ice cap on the ocean, you get very, very low sea salt concentrations. And you can see this seasonal cycle and sort of pin summer and winter solstices with not just those marine aerosols, but all sorts of the chemistry. You can see the annual signal. That method called annual layer counting, which again, if anyone was watching, you cannot dispute. You're just looking at the data and you can see annual signals and seasonal signals in these things.
Well, it's the equivalent of tree rings, right? Like, you know, not exactly.
People always say
but,
that.
Well, no, am I? And again, if I'm wrong, you say, no, Bill, that's not how it works.
Well, people always like to liken ice cores to tree rings. And it's just, I guess, the way my brain works. But tree rings are different because time is like concentric, right?
Yes. And yours is layered. But
and this is one directional. But I assume
there's a line. Yeah. There's a line between each, or there's at least something that marks in between each time period, right? Much like a tree ring. So if I drilled a core in a tree ring, it would look similar.
Wrong. To the center. Right. Yeah. Yes. No. Yeah. Conceptually, yes.
I like to be right once in a while.
Okay. I'll let you be right. Okay. Yeah. But so maybe the other one probably worth mentioning is stable isotopes. The ratio of heavy to light oxygen 16 to oxygen 18. This relationship is how we get temperature out of ice cores. And this is also something, so it's temperature dependent, and it's also something we utilize often in dating the ice during this annually layer, like the annual layer counting portion of our record. But it lets us extract temperature out of an ice core because it's, oh my God, should I really go into this?
Yes, you should.
Okay.
you're educating Bill. Don't worry about everybody else. How does oxygen 16 and 18 help you determine a temperature?
Okay. When you can imagine snow falling, if you have a heavy isotope and a light isotope, what is going to come out first, right? First thing to precipitate out would be
the heavy ones.
The heavy one. Ooh. Yeah.
2 points for Bill.
Yeah. 2-0, Bill. So that is basically what's behind this, that the temperature at which snow is falling has a temperature, right? It's controlled. Yeah. Okay, you get it. Okay, so there's a lot of different sort of isotopic ratios that are measured in various other species in ice. So I'm just talking about the one that gives us temperature records.
What else is in there? Like, what else do you see when you look at an ice core? You've talked about ash. You've talked about isotopes. Are we seeing pollen, for example? Are we seeing, like, what else are we seeing?
Yeah. People always want to know about things, which I don't actually look at myself, but some folks spend their whole career just looking at pollen, for example. Right. You can do DNA extractions and look at dissolved organic matter and sort of more directly biologically linked things in ice. Yeah, viruses and dead viruses.
Dead viruses.
Yeah, all sorts of things. There are other sort of the human imprint piece of it too, things we can look at from the Industrial Revolution till present, of course, that act as very clear sort of markers of how ubiquitous our imprint on the planet is. And lead isotopes is one, right? You can look at the phase out of leaded gasoline by measuring lead isotopes in ice cores anywhere on the planet. And that actually acts as another tie point because we know when leaded gasoline was phased out.
Yeah.
Just other examples.
So how do we, what's the actual physical process of getting an ice core out?
Well, it does depend where.
Okay.
But if we cut out the sort of getting to the spot, you need to go.
Okay. No, hang on. How do you find the spot you're going to do? Like what goes into finding a spot?
Okay. So usually a whole year before, once we have scientifically identified, okay, we want a climate record from this area. These are the reasons. This is what's driving it. We usually go out a whole year in advance and we do the site selection piece. We need to find the ideal location for drilling. And we do this with radar. You can use ground-based radar and or aerogeophysical radar, like mounted to a plane. Great if you can do both, but often we do this these ground-based surveys, and you're basically pulling a system around that, you know, pings a signal of energy from one unit, and there's a receiver nearby, and the pulse of energy that's being given off by the transmitter is reflecting not only off of the bedrock interface at the bottom between the ice and the bedrock and giving us, you know, a bottom depth, but it's also reflecting off every internal annual layer, any other layer that it reaches. So you can look at the internal stratigraphy, the layering of the snow from your skis all the way to the bedrock below. And there's a number of things this does. One, of course, we get a bedrock profile, so we can find areas where ice is deepest and theoretically most likely older to give a longer climate record. But we can also find areas that could be problematic to drill because of sort of funky flow, especially at depth near the bedrock interface, which would make it very difficult to date the ice. And it's kind of useless, again, if we can't date it. So we go through this kind of arduous process. Like, we're visiting this site a whole extra time, but it's really valuable in locating an ideal ice coring site. And I collaborate with people who are experts in this. I can drag radar around, but I don't do the processing and whatever. There's very talented people who do that. Yeah. And then usually, I mean, often we'll sort of publish like a site selection paper, or at least, you know, internally as a science group, you know, we have consensus. And once we have the spot, we go out the following year to the identified spot to do the drilling. Yeah. And so that's what goes into the lead up, I guess.
Yeah. And unlike a lot of people, you do your own drilling, I hear.
I do my own drilling. It started to really come in handy. yeah, I like doing it myself.
And what does it involve? How does it work?
Well, there's a few different drills. The one that I think I most commonly use was built in Whitehorse. It's an eclipse drill. It's a tipping tower drill that the whole thing all in all is around 900 pounds, which sounds like a lot, but it's modular. It breaks down into small pieces. You can move around by yourself in a sled. Like, you don't have to go somewhere, you know, with a skidoo. And you can build it in a couple hours. Like, two people can build this thing in, you know, half a day, say. And same with breaking it down. And it is a somewhat simple mechanical drill with a winch and a cable, an inner and an outer barrel. It has like this anti-torque section at the top. It's these spring-loaded arms that hold it tight in the bore hole so that the whole drill doesn't spin when it's cutting. Right. And we drill kind of about a meter at a time, right? So every time the drill is going down the borehole, we're drilling 1 meter, pulling it all the way back up to the surface, pulling the ice out of that inner barrel and sending it back down the hole, right? Oh,
yeah. Okay, yeah.
The nature of drilling changes as you go because, you know, you're reefing core out at the beginning because you're so close to the surface. But, you know, when you're 300 meters down, you might only drill a couple meters in a day because the drill is traveling for so many hours up and down.
What's the deepest you've drilled like that?
With a drill like this, we call it an intermediate depth drill. The core we drilled last year on Exelheiberg Island, it was 613 meters. Yeah. Outside of deep drilling projects, like, you know, the really deep Greenland and Antarctic projects, that's.
So how many? Yeah, sorry, 600 and what? Sorry?
It was 613 meters, which is almost twice as deep as any core that had ever been drilled in the Americas. So the Logan core before that was very close to the record at 327.
So
yeah.
One more.
I'm not sure this one's going to be beat.
So one more thing to add to the list.
This is like a huge team.
It's a huge team effort. I get it. So that 613 meters would cover how much time approximately? Because I'm sure it's...
Okay. Well, so we only know this from very preliminary stable isotope data so far. We were hoping for a full Holocene record, like that goes into the last glacial. Somewhere between 10 and 15,000 years old. And we know that we got that because you can see it. You can see the depth of the stable isotope record into the last glacial. So we know, and we don't have any constraint on the bottom few meters yet. So we know it's at least that old.
It's awesome. And you were talking really about you were talking about funky ice before, and I assume that means on a glacier, ice that's moved, the bottom layer is moved as opposed to the top layer. Am I, you know, is that correct? It's shifted.
Yeah, and Logan was an example of this. A lot of times in high mountain terrain, there's things going on that are sort of unavoidable. Like you can avoid this kind of stuff in general, you know, when you're doing like if you're drilling on a big ice sheet, basically. But in a high mountain setting on a glacier where there is nowhere that has zero horizontal velocity, like the ice is always flowing, there's some amount of flow basically with any site you're going to pick, and it's something that you'll have to be able to kind of deconvolve after, which can be, you know, it'll have a modeling component to it, also something I don't do myself, and can be kind of complex to like to unravel.
Bring in the team again, right?
Yeah.
We've mentioned Mount Logan a couple of times now, and just so everybody knows, today the forecast for Mount Logan is currently it's minus 38 with a wind chill of minus 60. I guess we call that a feels like temperature now. And a forecast of winds of 105 kilometer an hour tonight. So even Allison's happy she's not going to be at Mount Logan today, but you have been there a number of times. What have you done in Mount Logan besides drill ice cores?
I'm so glad I'm not standing at the weather station that's reporting to you the horrific temperature right now. Cause that is a very inhospitable spot. What else have I done there? Well, I've climbed it three times. Once was for fun, air quotes. The second time was the radar, to do radar and to install the weather station, that data came from. Yes. And that weather station, it's at 18,500 feet. It's actually on Prospector's Call, which is that high point if you're climbing the standard route that you go up and over to go to the summit plateau.
We all did that just last week.
I thought so. It's pretty standard. Yes, no, it's sitting up there reporting, I think, everything except it's not reporting wind right now because
the problem with the wind.
It's rhymed up. Yeah.
Shoddy work.
I didn't know this was a roast. shoddy work. Let's see. Okay, so that was 2021 when we installed it. We installed that weather station and then did the radar survey.
And what was important about the crew that installed the weather station?
Well, I did it with my climbing partner Rebecca.
So it was an all-woman crew, right?
Well, it was technically. There were two folks from the Alpine Club of Canada as well who ended up being quite instrumental, and we hooked up with up there to get all the science pulled off, and we couldn't have done any of that without them. But yeah, that year Rebecca and I, we were a team of two, but again, we were linked up with Zach and Toby, another team of two.
How do you see this progressing in the future? Like, where do you think ice cores can take us, or where do you think the analysis of ice cores can take us? Is there something left to be done as far as analyzing ice cores?
You know, it's a timely question. I think I can answer that for myself, and I can sort of try to answer that for the broader ICE Corps community, at least take a shot at it. In terms of the broader ICE Corps community, there's about 300 of us, like ICE Corps scientists in general, and we get together every 4 years, and this year is one of them. We kind of get together every 4 years, and it is a really galvanizing time I've found since I was a student in terms of sort of setting community priorities. And I would say over the last, I guess, 8-ish years, the last two sort of sets of these gatherings, what was identified among the broader community was finding much older ice, million-year-old ice, in fact, which has beat the longest ice core records to date. Before this push, the longest ice core record was around 800,000 years old. And you may have seen in the news, like over the last year, that this was beat by a lot. And so that like multinational push for what was being called million-year-old ice, but turns out the US and some other countries have been very successful in finding even older ice than that. Like I wasn't a part of this. I've just in awe watched it. And a lot of that had to do with, you know, a lot of countries coming together with all of their resources and expertise and making these, you know, explorations happen in the few spots that, you know, that the community thought this ice would exist. I don't really know what the next huge question, like the million-year-old ice thing, is going to be, but I have a sense that it's going to come out of this meeting in October where we're all gathering.
Where do 300 ice scientists gather?
Well, ready for this? It's always in Europe. It always, because there's more Europeans in this gig than elsewhere. And a few of us in North America put in bids, and it's going to be in Banff at the Banff Center. I put a bid for the Banff Center. A couple of scientists put in for Vancouver Island and in Oregon. And
that's awesome.
The Banff bid wins. So all these incredible people are coming to the Banff Center in October. Yeah.
Good for you. That's amazing. Good for you.
It's
good
really
for Banff.
Cool. I know. Well, and good for Canada. Like we're going to get, it's incredible to have everyone come here also as our National Ice Core Lab is like pretty fully off the ground, and we're trying to, you know, collaborate more with the new countries and things like that. I think it will be wonderful timing. Yeah, but I guess that's sort of, I'm not, you know, punting. I think that the next big sort of priorities will be set in October. And I maybe have a hunch that at least one of them will be aligned with what I was going to say are sort of my own personal ones, which are really identifying more of these high elevation non-polar places to drill. And there is a European group, the Ice Memory Project, that has this mandate and have been doing incredible work drilling, you know, in the Italian Alps and other places, and retrieving these climate records that are being rapidly lost in, you know, they'll have a big presence at this meeting in October. And I feel like that might actually be a big part of it, which excites me because I have some sort of targets in my own mind about ice coring expeditions I want to lead in the next few years. And most of them are in that realm. They're non-polar high mountain.
What do we learn different in the non-polar high mountain glacier ice that we don't learn in the Arctic ice?
Well, it depends which spot, right? I gave the Columbia ice field example, which is a really good one for where we are here.
Yeah.
And a lot of that one does have to do with anticipating water quality, right?
Right.
Just
water, period, right? I mean,
and water, period.
It's melting at an incredible rate. I only know because I visit.
Yes.
I try to go every year. I try and go every year. I go every time I'm out there. And I'm amazed at how far the glacier has retreated, even in my time visiting, hasn't been that long. It's been, I'm going to say, 14, 15 years now. And it's incredible how much it's moved, like how much farther away it is. So yeah, there's that part of it too, right? I mean,
totally.
You're working on a limited resource that's disappearing very quickly. Unfortunately.
Yeah, that one is. With the markers, they had the annual markers showing the recession of the terminus.
Yeah,
it's a really good sort of public awareness.
What are you doing next?
There's a spot in the Karakoram that I want to make it happen. So I'm saying it out loud now. I've told a few people, I've asked a few people to be on the team. Shockingly, they've said yes. So, I mean, realistically, the drilling will probably be in 2028. But I hope it blows Logan out of the water. That's all I'm going to say right now.
That's good.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Allison. This has been great. It's been everything I thought it was going to be, and that's quite the accomplishment.
That was Allison Crisitello, director of the Canadian Ice Core Lab. You can learn more about Allison's work and the Canadian Ice Core Lab through the University of Alberta, and as always, we'll include the links in the show notes. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can find more episodes of Northern Latitudes wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to support the show, please consider sharing the episode or leaving a review. It really does help. For even more Northern Latitudes content, including the podcast archives, my photography, and the Northern Latitudes events, go to northernlatitudes.ca. Our theme music and sound logo, produced and performed by John Sanfilippo of Soundwise in Kingston, Ontario. Today's closing music is Ice and Snow from Acreage. Send me an email with comments, suggestions, or just to say hi, podcast@northernlatitudes.ca. Until next time, I'm Bill Ault. Find your way to Northern Latitudes.